WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Holocaust survivors have asked us to never forget. Two things this year have helped keep the Holocaust in the public consciousness: the opening of the Holocaust Museum, and now the film Schindler's List. On this archive edition of our program, we're going to hear an interview we recorded last April on the 50th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. After the Germans invaded Poland in 1939, all the Jews of Warsaw, about 138,000 people, were herded into the ghetto, which was walled off from the rest of the city in 1940. Thousands of Jews died of starvation and disease. Thousands of others had been sent to the gas chambers. 50 years ago, when German soldiers came to destroy the ghetto, they were fought off by Jews with Molotov cocktails, stones, and handmade weapons. The Jews could never have won, but they heroically resisted the Germans for 3 weeks. Raphael Scharf edited a book of never-before-published photographs taken in the ghetto one summer day in 1941. Scharf is a Polish Jew who lost most of his family in the Holocaust. He now lives in England, where he has set up the Library of Holocaust Survivors. The pictures in his new book were taken by a German soldier named Willie George. Scharf tracked down these photos as soon as he heard about their existence.
I found myself on the doorstep of the soldier photographer. I entered, accompanied by some of my friends, and it did, in fact, transpire that this gentleman, whom I was facing in his own home, 50 years ago, almost to a day, entered the Warsaw Ghetto. Now, he was, by profession, a photographer. Hence, of course, the quality of the pictures that he took. Anyway, he entered the ghetto at about 10 o'clock in the morning, armed with his Leica, an early model, and started taking snapshots. Now, the landscape, the human landscape, which he found, was, of course, totally unexpected to him. He didn't quite understand what he was seeing. But it was so unusual and exotic that he took a great number of snaps.
Had this soldier been told to take pictures by his commander?
Can I expand at length? Have we got time to tell you? During the war, I was in the British Army in the intelligence corps, and my task was interrogating German prisoners of war. Now, when I found myself face to face with a former German soldier, all my antennae started vibrating. Now, I knew more about the scene than he did. Now, trying to get the facts from him, who sent him there, what was he seeing, how did he feel about it, all that I very soon realized with my past experience, this was quite futile. What we are talking about was something which happened 50 years ago. The man was now about 80. That day in the ghetto was not at that time a tremendous event in his life. In fact, to the point that when he took these snapshots and sent them to his wife, he forgot all about them. And it's only very, very recently, because he's getting old and making order in his drawers, that he discovered these films. So I realized there was not much point interrogate him on that score, because, like all the German prisoners of war under interrogation, he was telling me not what he really remembered or felt, but what he thought I wanted to hear.
What did he tell you?
Well, he told me, now the bare story is that he he was known in his group. He was of a very, very humble rank. In his group, it was known that he had a camera, and to make himself pocket money, like soldiers do, he used to take snapshots of his colleagues to send home. So his commanding officer knew that he was a photographer, and I think out of sheer curiosity, since the unit was stationed within an earshot of the Warsaw Ghetto, he asked him, gave him a pass, so Willy Georg tells me, and he entered the ghetto and started taking the snapshots. Now, this was not allowed. Photographs other than the official photographs, which were taken on occasions, were not allowed. Now, he was lucky that he roved through the ghetto freely until towards the evening. He was, in fact, apprehended by the German police, who forced him to open the camera and destroy the film that was in it. But he did not tell them, and I put this to his credit, he did not tell them that he already had four rolls in his pocket. Now, after that, he was pushed out of the ghetto, and as he tells me, he went immediately to a photographic studio, a Polish photographic studio outside the ghetto walls, and developed the film. Now, he's terribly, terribly proud of his, and justly so, of his professional competence, that these films, 50 years on, are as crisp, as fresh, as if they were taken yesterday.
You write at the end of the book, to many of us who grew up within or next to that human landscape and who remember it lovingly, these people, shameful to confess, did not at that time look attractive. These misty eyes, beards, sidelocks, crooked noses. One looked away, embarrassed by what a non-Jewish onlooker might feel or say. Could you expand a little bit about that, on that complicated feeling that you express?
Did I write that? What you read to me, did I write that? How very well put. Well, look, one could write volumes on this. There was a vast section of the population of Jews in Poland who were indistinguishable from the Polish population around them. Assimilated both in dress, in speech, in interests, in dedication to ideals, differing from the Polish neighbors only by origin, by religion, which they often did not practice anyway. Now then, there was another section of the population which was Orthodox, both in dress, in manners, in interest, and they might just as well have lived in any other country and retained their appearance and habits as they did in Poland. A great many of them, for all I know, of that section, never spoke to a Pole in their lives. They lived within a Jewish society which was self-sufficient, and you could be born and grow up and study and die and marry and have children and be surrounded by Jews alone. There were such large centers of Jews in Poland. And one of them, of course, the largest of all, was in Warsaw. So what we see here in these pictures, these faces, which I then describe somewhere as Rembrandtesque, these bearded with misty eyes, with crooked noses and so on, they do in fact represent this section of the population which I just described.
My guest is Raphael Scharf, editor of the book In the Warsaw Ghetto, Summer 1941. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Raphael Scharf, founder of the Library of Holocaust Survivors in England. The photographs are accompanied by Warsaw Ghetto Diaries that that you've chosen.
Yes.
Are these diaries that you found, or are they collected in archives? How did you get them?
No, this is public property. I have no proprietary rights to the diaries. They do exist. Now, what one has to bear in mind is that in one respect, the Germans were very unlucky in the choice of their victims. They chose very literary people. Everybody felt that what was happening was so startling, so unusual, so unbelievable, that it had to be put on record. Now, a great, great many people, since among the Jews there are a great many people who are literate, started writing and putting these things on record. Now, all that might not have reached us if not for the idea and the work of one single person by the name of Emanuel Ringelblum, a historian and sociologist, who had this idea that everything had to be recorded. And he organized a network of people which spread through the country, not only in Warsaw, to write all that they saw, to supply labels, all printed matters, documents which they came across, posters which they stripped off the wall, and brought it to him to form the archives of the ghetto. Now, when the noose started tightening, and he himself, although he and his wife and his son lived at that time hidden outside the ghetto, he felt that his days might be numbered, and he organized a group of people who collected all those archives, that is, all the reports that he received, the posters, the labels, all the written matter by adults and by children, and sealed them in milk churns and steel boxes and buried them under an address which is known to us in Warsaw. Now, virtually everything that we know of what was happening there at the time is due to the materials which come from the Ringelblum archives. Now, these archives were partly, unfortunately only partly, recovered after the war, some of it already in 1945 or 6, some of it in 1950, and the rest is lost.
Emanuel Ringelblum, who gathered all these materials, he did not survive the war.
He did not survive. He was denounced, and police came for him and took him. Actually, he did not live. He lived in a garden house of a Polish peasant, and was taken to the, actually we know that, to the ground of the ghetto and shot with he and his wife and his son. And he, I think, is the great unsung hero of those times.
I wonder if anybody in your family kept memoirs during the war.
Look, you speak of my family. Just by a coincidence, you might say, if I am to speak of my family, the majority of them on my father's side come from a little town not far from Krakow called Oświęcim, which became Auschwitz. Now, in that Oświęcim, which was then accursed with the name Auschwitz, the majority of the population were Jews, and among them the clan of Scharfs. I have counted myself now from memory relatives. There were over 50 people whom I listed. Now, among them, there is not a single survivor. They did not have far to go. Now, if you ask me whether any of them kept diaries. They may have done because they were on the whole very literate, being of long rabbinical stock, but they have not reached me.
Well, you have a library of survivors' material in England, a library of diaries and memoirs of survivors. Tell me why you decided to set that up.
Look, this... I'm not alone in this. I'm alive. When the rest of them are dead. And I've always felt that duty, that having survived, I owe something to those who have not survived. And how am I to pay that debt other than by cultivating the memory and trying to make those who want to forget not to allow them to forget. So within my modest means, I am no great scholar, I am immersed, you could say, day and night in those materials to the virtual exclusion of other reading matter, which I think is an enormous impoverishment. But when I take up a book to read for pleasure, I feel that I'm wasting time. I'm not allowed to do it.
Can I ask how you got out of Poland during the war?
Well, no, I didn't. No, I came down. This is, I came to England just before the war. I left Poland before the war. I was a foreign correspondent to a Polish Jewish newspaper in Krakow, and I came to London already in 1938. So that's one more reason. I was not really a part of it. All my burden that I carry is the, you could say, the burden of an absentee. I was not there myself.
How did you know to get out?
I didn't. I got out. Lots of people got out. I didn't get out because had I known what was happening, I would have got out not only myself, but I would have carried my family with me perhaps. No, I had no idea what will happen. And although in retrospect it looks almost silly to say that one didn't know the war was coming, it was not all that obvious. I came to England, I was struck by this enormous power of the British Empire, and since this was for all the world to see, didn't Hitler see this? Would he dare? That's how it looked at that time. Now in retrospect it looks silly. But I did not get out of Poland because I thought that the war was coming. Had I known that the war was coming, I would think twice about getting out.
You got out for professional reasons?
For professional reasons. Also, I was a little bit tired of life in Poland. I saw wide horizons. And if truth be told, I saw England, as it were, as a staging post only in my journey to Palestine, where I wanted to land eventually.
Can you tell us a little bit more what it was like when you, the first time you went back to Poland?
Now, the first time I went back was, as I mentioned before, it was in June 1945, because I received news from the first emissary who came from Krakow, that there are a few Jews left, or few Jews who came back to Krakow already when the war ended, and that my mother is among them. Whereupon, I didn't think twice, I was at that time in the British Army, details won't matter, I've organized myself transport, and I drove hell for leather day and night, until I came to Krakow and knocked at my mother's door.
And she was home?
She was waiting for me. I would not have come without warning her, because she would not have survived the shock. She knew that I was on the way. And often I took her with me. She lived with us still in London for 10 years. And I spent those 10 years, you could say, at her bedside, where she was telling me endlessly her story. And therefore, I feel I had sort of first-hand evidence from an eyewitness immediately after.
And what you've been doing ever since is collecting stories of other people.
Well, look, this is not terribly relevant to what you're saying, because I say I was collecting stories. This is not and could not have been my full-time job. I had to earn a living. So even though this is a lifelong interest, I led a normal life, and I have a family and a wife and children and grandchildren, and on the face of it, live a life which is indistinguishable from that of my neighbor.
What are some of the thoughts that come to your mind on this 50th anniversary of the start of the uprising?
I would like this to be remembered. I very often have the feeling that the memory of it only surfaces on anniversaries. But I think that it is necessary to know what had happened, how it happened, who was responsible for it, and what was lost in the process. I think it's necessary to remember it all the time.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Raphael Scharf edited the book In the Warsaw Ghetto, Summer 1941, featuring photographs of the ghetto and passages from ghetto diaries. It's published by Aperture. Our interview is recorded April 19th of this year. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.